Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We are at the Reporters Roundtable tonight with a look at some of the top stories of the week. On deck tonight, a pedestrian bridge collapse in D.C., President Biden announcing a crackdown on violent crime and illegal guns. Also, Capitol Hill politics, voting rights, D.C. statehood, Loudoun County schools, and an active NFL player comes out. Whew. Yes, indeed. Lots to talk about with my guests, Ingrid Sturgis, Assistant Chair and Professor with the Howard University Department of Media, Journalism and Film, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist with Roll Call. Lines are open. What do you think? Give us a call, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ingrid, Mary, thanks for joining the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and I'm honored to be here with my old friend Ingrid.
Well, there you go. Kumbaya moment on the Daily Drum. Let us talk, and you know, Ingrid, I'll let you have the first bite at the apple. This bridge collapse on D.C. 295. Fortunately, no one was killed. We had some injuries, 5 people. But the big news is nothing like this has really ever happened in D.C. as it relates to a pedestrian bridge collapse, major thoroughfare. It took me 2 hours to get to work today coming down. Well, I had to come down 95 instead of 295, and I went around College Park and then East-West Highway through Queens Chapel, all of that just to get here because it was a traffic mess. But the big issue is that it raises a question about infrastructure, a bigger political issue.
Well, it seems in this case it was a truck that went under the bridge, and it seemed to have torn down part of the bridge, and they were wondering if the bridge had dropped a little bit because they said the truck should have been able to fit under the bridge. So there could be an infrastructure issue here, but I don't know that they know for sure. They said the truck should have fit. There was all kinds of fuel that was spilled, and so there were issues about how to clean it up and whether or not it was going to pollute something. So this infrastructure issue is really big, and I think more and more of us are going to see this issue about having to reroute ourselves because of accidents and all of this kind of stuff. But fortunately, nobody was hurt.
Yeah.
But they do want to find out whether or not the bridge had dropped a little, and that's why the truck couldn't get through.
Mary, the D.C. officials say that this bridge passed inspection 4 months ago in February. That's the good news. And even if the bridge was sound, and I bring up the infrastructure issue because it still will need to be replaced. And those are dollars that need to go into a repairing, that bridge and the other issues, not just in this city, but across the country.
That's true. And even if indeed it was the collision that caused this, the truck, as Ingrid said, supposedly should have been able to go under it. So there's some problems there. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the bridges around the country, annually there are lists of the 10 most dangerous ones. And I think they just had a collapse at a bridge. There's several bridges around the country that are dangerous. I'm based in North Carolina now, and there's several that you kind of hold your breath when you're going over. Mm-hmm. And that is a real need in this country, and we know this. And we also know that the bill is stalled, as several bills are, trying to wait for some kind of bipartisan compromise in Congress. And people want something to be done, because that's something that you can really see. I mean, they are even arguing over the definition of infrastructure. Is it just bridges and roads, or is it also internet and things like that? So you would hope that even if this isn't exactly what folks are talking about, that people will see the need of having really solid, strong infrastructure in this country. And thank goodness no one was killed, although people were hurt. But you can't really count on this happening with these incidents across the country.
Absolutely. And I think, to Mary's point, Ingrid, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, this political gridlock that we see on Capitol Hill for anything, whether it's infrastructure or voting, it just seems to be pro forma now when you're talking about White House Capitol Hill politics.
I don't know how we're going to get out of this gridlock, because the Republicans want to stall on everything and they don't really want to collaborate with the Democrats. And so it's going to be tough to get a lot of the things that Biden wants to accomplish. The Voting Rights Act that he was trying to get through is been stonewalled, and they're trying to re-strategize to figure out how to get that passed or get that through and to support voting rights across the country. So it's going to be really tough. And the Republicans keep digging their heels in, and they don't want to give any ground. And even some of the Democrats, when you're talking about the filibuster, are not interested in taking that on. So I don't know where we go from here. It's going to be tough. But I'm hoping that Biden has a few tricks up his sleeves. And we can't give up hope on getting through some of the important issues that we're interested in, infrastructure, voting rights, because there's always something that's going to happen, and we don't know what that's going to be that's going to turn the tide.
Indeed so. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So, Mary, let us talk about President Biden's announcement today, trying to address the rise in violent crime across this country, as well as illegal guns, particularly ghost guns, and the impact that these issues have on American cities. The mayor of Baltimore, Brandon Scott, said today that this is, you know, the first president in a while who has, you know, tried to step up and address these cities. And Baltimore, D.C., obviously, Chicago, for example, having a terrible, terrible time with deadly gun violence.
Oh, yeah. And that's my hometown, Baltimore. And I still have a sister and brother who live there. And it's a really complex issue, because actually crime has gone down a bit, but the gun violence and the homicides have gone up. And we're coming out of this year of COVID, which is complicates it even more. And then he has competing interests. Of course, Republicans are always going to attack Democrats as being soft on crime and trying to tag them with the defund the police slogan, which is kind of rich considering the police officers who were attacked on January 6th that they don't seem too concerned with. But so Biden also has folks in the Democratic Party, progressive, who don't want this spike to result in, you know, police policies that are onerous and that will put the thumb and stop police reform, which is needed, obviously. So he is going through it, looking through the lens of gun control, which is a popular issue among Democrats, and saying he wants to crack down on gun stores that don't follow federal rules. At the same time, he wants to provide more support for police departments, and also step up programs for recently released convicts to try to stop the recidivism. So he's coming at it from all angles. But of course, public safety is an issue that is right there for people to see. So they are very concerned about it. We saw it become a big issue in the New York mayoral race, because people sense that there was more street violence, and you have a couple of really outrageous instances of it, and people are concerned about it. So it's both an issue that's a tough one to crack, but people will not hesitate to make it a political cudgel.
But here's the thing, Ingrid. Even if the federal government is offering resources, of course, this proposal by the president is still going to need the backing of congressional action. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that Joe Biden gets his wishes and is able to provide more assistance to cities that are dealing with deadly gun violence, particularly in communities of color. How do you balance the need to address these issues with help from the federal government with the suspicion and issues regarding trust of the police in communities of color? So you want to bring more police in here to deal with our with violence, but we don't want more police in here to deal with violence because some would argue the police are violent themselves. Help me here, Ingrid.
Well, you know, communities of color have a mixed relationship with the police department. On the one hand, they want the police to protect them from violent crime and violence in their neighborhoods. But on the other hand, they're also the victim of some of the police brutality. So you can see that very much in the New York mayor's race, where Eric Adams looks like he's going to take the lead for mayor, a former police officer. And it seems to me that, you know, I'm a New Yorker, so I come at this from that perspective, because in New York, I know that the communities of color want police in their neighborhoods. They want to eliminate crime. They want to feel like they're safe. But on the other hand, you had stop and frisk for so many years, where so many young men and women were victimized by the police. So there's got to be a balance. And, you know, I'm looking at what Eric Adams might do to kind of bridge that gap, because he talks about helping to stop and frisk. But on the other hand, he really believes in more police officers in the neighborhood. So there's got to be some way for the community and the police to find common ground so that the people trust the police. The police are never going to trust everybody, but the people ought to be able to trust the people who they pay in their taxes to serve them.
Yeah, I always used to say I grew up in a community that was underprotected and over-policed.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. As Ingrid says, you want protection, but you just want to be treated as a citizen who deserves protection, not as an automatic perp.
Yes.
It makes a lot of sense there. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. If you want to get in on the conversation, be my guest. Give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. I want to go back to the Capitol Hill politics situation more broadly, and also kind of have an opportunity to drill down on some of the specific issues. But let's talk about the overarching issue right now. As we mentioned before, the partisan politics. Yesterday, the Senate couldn't even vote to agree to talk about, you know, S1, the voting bill. And not are we going to vote on the bill, but can we agree to at least talk about it? Real quick, Mary, before I go to the break, give me something on that. That is just amazing to me.
It was such a cynical discussion. I have a column about it coming out in Roll Call. I deal with it with my podcast, Equal Time, with Mary C. Curtis, because they were using some of the same language about states' rights, the Republicans were, that you heard in the 60s when people were arguing against, then there were Democrats, Southern Democrats, the Voting Rights Act, because you needed federal intervention to protect the voting rights of African Americans, because when you leave it up to the states, they will not hesitate, as we can see from all of these laws in the states that are restricting voting rights. Not only the rights of the vote, but who counts the votes once they are cast. And, you know, when Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, says it is a power grab, well, actually the power grab are all these states. And that's what this For the People Act would combat. But as you said, they don't even want to discuss it. And, I think that it is an issue that is not being taken seriously enough, because it's an issue voting rights for all Americans. Even the disabled are saying you're going to make it tougher for us to vote, and it affects our democracy in the long run.
I need to take a quick break. Ingrid, are you going to hang with us for a little while longer? Do we have
yes,
to let
I can.
You go? Well, thank you so much, because I want to get your input on that voting issue as well. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're at the Reporters Roundtable. Going to take a quick break. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, the app, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2, as well as 98.3 FM. We are at the Reporters Roundtable talking about some of the top stories of the week. My guests are Ingrid Sturgis, Assistant Chair and Professor with the Howard University Department of Media, Journalism, and Film, Mary C. Curtis, columnist with Roll Call, and Jamila Bay, political editor with Viacom. Give us a call if you have a comment or a question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I take a little issue with what you said before the break, Mary, where you said that Republicans aren't taking this voting rights thing seriously.
Oh, no, I didn't mean Republicans weren't. I think that Democrats should be leaning into it more, because it is a matter of democracy. Oh, no, I think Republicans are taking it very seriously, because these laws in the states show that rather than put out their ideas and try to get the most people to vote for them, they would rather choose their voters and rather than have the voters choose them, between the gerrymandering and all of these laws that end same-day registration, and in Georgia make it against the law to give people water in long lines, and we know the lines are longer in minority precincts, and in Texas, which the proposed law that has so far been stalled, but it looks like it, the Governor Greg Abbott is going to bring in the legislature to vote on it, they are going to let poll watchers have more free reign to take pictures of people when they're voting. This is old-fashioned intimidation. Oh, it is very serious, and they're taking it seriously. I just think that it is existential, and you see now people are fighting back. Busloads of people, like the old civil rights marchers, are going to Washington. A group from Arizona, where Senator Kristen Sinema is from, William Barber, the Reverend William Barber, and the Poor People's March, they were at the Supreme Court today with people from all over. I think people are really getting engaged on this issue.
Well, I could not have said it any better, and that was exactly my point, is that the Republicans are taking these voting issues very seriously, but not in the way that these bills, these voter reform bills, would impact people of color and people who want to expand access to voting. So, yes, absolutely. I agree with you 100%. Your thoughts about that, Ingrid?
Well, the thing is that the Republicans can't win on the merits. The country's becoming more liberal. We have transgender and gay rights and all of those people demanding their rights. We have African-Americans demanding their rights. We have everybody wanting more freedom and not less. And so the Republicans feel threatened existentially, as Mary said, because they can't win on the merits. The numbers of Republicans are shrinking. The number of Democrats may not be growing, but the number of independents are growing. And so once you have all of these people who are not for the issues that the Republicans espouse, and some of those issues are shrinking because they used to be for small government. And when Trump was in, he expanded government so much. And so,
deficits.
He expanded deficits, right. But so they can't win on the merit. So they're doing all kinds of machinations that would gain them votes, like fiddling with the Electoral College and allowing local states to have more rights and overturning the votes if they don't like the way it goes. And so they're doing all these kinds of things because they're shrinking and they're the country's becoming more diverse with more diverse issues, and so they feel threatened, and they're doing everything they can to stay in power, and that's how they do it, by imposing these new laws on people. So as Mary said, people are starting to turn out, and they're starting to wake up and say, hey, I'm not going to stand for this. So it's yet to be seen how regular, everyday Americans react to this, and I think the onus is on the Democrats to sound the alarm that these things can happen if you're not paying attention. And I think some of that is starting to happen, but I'm afraid that it may not happen soon enough and people may not wake up soon enough.
Jamila Bey, your thoughts about where we are right now with this partisan gridlock, particularly as it relates to voter reform on Capitol Hill.
Oh, good evening. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much.
I'm on with two of my favorite other journalists, so I'm going to try and, you know, do some justice up here. Look, we right now in these United States are, you know, in Reconstruction Part 2. Every time Black Americans have had any modicum of power at the ballot box, power at the polling place, there has been a pervasive, distinct, and chilling white backlash. Today, we are still, I would argue, paying for the election of Barack Obama in 2008. The fact that you have 46 different states trying to make it harder for Black people explicitly, and also Hispanics, and also poor people, and also the formerly incarcerated to vote. Make no mistake, this is anti-Black backlash. And these Republicans do very well to exploit that. Their dying, constricting base love that red meat of let's take it back the way it was. And that is one of the reasons why we're seeing all of this. We're going to continue to see the likes of these, you know, as well explained earlier in this program. But this is just heating up. What we see at the Senate level, we're seeing in the state houses, we're seeing in the state senates, and we're seeing in the city councils. They are coming for the votes of the likes of us.
And you have it in the courts, too, because so many judges now, conservative judges, the Supreme Court, which, of course, invalidated in 2013, key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, you would have had to have all of these laws pre-cleared. And look, they don't really represent a lot of people when you consider how many judges on the court were put there by presidents that didn't get the popular vote. The last three, for sure.
Yes.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable. Let's go to Ken. Ken calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Ken. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. Yeah, I've been a police officer for almost 30 years now in Camden, New Jersey, on active duty military now in the District of Columbia. But I've been Black all my life. And I see the issues that happen in the communities and with the youth that I work with. What I see is that our youth are suffering from a cultural identity crisis, that they're being taught by people or conditioned by people, and we're not taking a greater enough responsibility. We're depending on others. Even in the last election, although there was relief by voting Biden in, our only choice was to vote for either two white men. That was our only choice. I don't think we hold, in particular, Democrats accountable enough. I think James Baldwin said in an interview in the 1980s, he told a reporter, I don't know you personally, but I know you historically. And we're at that point where we are still trying to figure things out when the evidence is clear. The evidence has always been there that they don't have our best interests in mind. No other race does, nor should they. We have to really push our own agendas, especially at the younger ages. And by cultural identity crisis for our children, I meant that Asian children or other children may have an American-sounding first name, but they will retain their cultural ancestry through their last name, which our children don't. And not so much that a name changes anything, but history does, so that we won't be quite as shocked as we seem to be right now with what they're doing on Capitol Hill. let alone throughout the nation. This is nothing new.
Okay. Ken, thank you so much for your comment. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are at the Reporters Roundtable, and I wanted to also thank Ingrid Sturgis for participating in this program. In this part of the conversation, we're going to let Ingrid go. But if you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. On to some of the other things. As a native Washingtonian and someone who loves, you know, Washington, D.C. so much, one of the things that I think is really distressing to me is to watch the hearing, the Senate committee hearing yesterday on government operations, Homeland Security, where we had, you know, the mayor of Washington, D.C. constantly repeat these same statistics that we all know, and giving all of these reasons why D.C. should be a state, and to see those who are against seeing it happen, are calling it a power grab, who are talking about constitutional issues, and the fact that, yes, the D.C. statehood bill, it passed the House, but it's almost a foregone conclusion. It may get out of committee. It may get out of committee. Maybe. But if it gets into the Senate, it's going to be the same thing that we saw yesterday with the procedural vote on, you know, the voting bill, Mary. It's not going anywhere.
No, it isn't, because they're afraid that you'll have two Democratic senators. And even though the Republican senators represent a far fewer amount of Americans, they do like that advantage for those big rural states. And it's just disheartening because, of course, D.C. has more people than what? Vermont, than Wyoming, than some states. And the rhetoric around it always seems to be that somehow the people of D.C. don't deserve it. They're not like other people, and it's not like other places. And, you know, like I said, I grew up down the road. You're from Washington. And you have this taxation without representation, right? And to hear it as described as a naked power grab is insulting, because these are Americans who serve in wars, who pay taxes, and they don't have this power.
Yeah. Jamila, your thoughts about, you know, this situation with You know, with D.C. statehood, I think, as we used to say, it's too much like right.
Much like right, indeed. Quick pop quiz. One time in the history of these United States did an elected official be denied the right to speak about legislation that affects that elected official's particular constituency in the House. It happened one time. And since this country has been a country, it was when in 2012, Eleanor Holmes Norton was denied the right to speak about a 20-week abortion ban that Republican senators, one in particular from California, was leading the charge on here in Washington, D.C. There was a panel of all men, and Eleanor Holmes Norton, a woman, got up to talk about this women's health issue, and she was told, sit your black behind down, Eleanor, you don't matter. That can only happen in a place where, you know, we have been subject here in D.C. to the whims and the authority of those who have the, you know, electorate power over us. D.C. becoming a state is a necessity, but we have to go back to that whole filibuster conversation that we put on the table about yesterday.
And more broadly, when you talk about the partisan split, and I understand when we have, you know, when we have, you know, voter advocates who say, you know, that people of color need to get out there and vote and not let anything prevent them from doing so, and so that at some point the balance of power, for example, in the Senate, and we saw that happen in Georgia with the election of two Democratic senators. But I think that we have to be realistic, and certainly, you know, I'll start with Mary. We have to be realistic that not every this country is very diverse politically, and that not, you know, not every constituency looks like Maryland, Virginia, or D.C., and that, and there are people you may not like the way that, and if you're a Democrat, if you're a progressive person, you may not like the way that the conservatives view the country, view the world, and how they vote. But there's a reason why there are 50 conservative senators on Capitol Hill, because they represent a part of America that in many cases people of color do not necessarily agree with, and it's very, very difficult, as we've seen, for a Mitch McConnell to be defeated in Kentucky, because there are just too many conservative Republican voters who like what he is doing. And so I don't believe that, unless there is some kind of huge demographic shift in some of these conservative states, your Wyomings, your North Dakotas, South Dakotas, and even Texas, I don't see that there's going to be any change, particularly in the Senate, Mary.
Well, you did see, it's not that long ago, some of those states had Democratic senators. And so some of it, I think, is messaging. A lot of it is manipulated, because you do see the gerrymandering, the packing and stacking, you know, all the minority folks in these states. Because you do have minority people in Nebraska and things like that, but they put them in certain districts. So it really isn't representative when you look at the census. Even here in North Carolina, it's kind of a purple state, 50-50. But the congressional delegation is majority Republican because of gerrymandering. And I think there is a frustration because, you know, the Democrats said, we really need you to get out, everybody, and vote to send two Democratic senators from Georgia. And they did, and they have a majority. And then they say, well, we're kind of hamstrung by this filibuster thing. We can't get things done. You saw Mitch McConnell with a slim majority change the filibuster rules so he could shove three justices on the Supreme Court, including breaking his own rule about it when there's election going on. I mean, voting had started by the time he put Amy Coney Barrett on the court, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg was barely, you know, she was just died, right? And so he plays politics like a blood sport, and his goal is power. And I do think that people are frustrated with Democrats sometimes, where they feel like they're playing a whole different game, that they're still talking bipartisanship and things like this. When the Republicans, does anybody think that Mitch McConnell, in the same position, would kill the filibuster or do whatever he had to do to push through the legislation that he wanted? Because he did.
But elections have consequences, and we certainly know that. And if I think if the shoe were on the other foot, you know, the Democrats would do the same. As we remember, you know, President Trump saying on that recording, all I need is 11,000 however many votes. Well, that's all he needed to overturn the election, but that's what he got to lose the election. And so, you know, I think the reality is that, yes, elections have consequences, and, you know, whoever wins has the ability to... Go ahead.
That's an incredibly optimistic and fair-minded way of looking at a stacked deck, loaded dice, and a moving goalpost.
Yes.
Every time black folks say, okay, fine, we're going to play it your way, you wind up with Stacey Abrams being denied the fact that that woman should be the governor of the great state of Georgia. When we say, okay, fine, we're going to do it your way, we're going to play by your rules, we're going to register people to vote the way y'all go out and register people to vote. I'm looking back in the early 1980s when Jefferson Beauregard Sessions was, was Attorney General in Alabama and locked up black women for doing the identical voting registration procedures that Republican white folks were doing. They move the goalposts, they shift the finish line every time we play by the rules, and it looks as though we're going to win. That's the problem. Gerrymandering is a word that people go, oh, yeah, they talk about that. But if you think about a square and somebody goes in there and they draw an ellipse and then put a rhombus on the corner of the ellipse, and then they extend one corner of that rhombus out in a nice flourishy swish that comes into a concentric circle in order to break up black districts, to break up poor districts, to break up the districts that have a whole bunch of women in it that will not vote for the candidate, and they say, oh, we're redistricting, we're drawing it, and you have something that you go, how did you get that never before seen in nature shape out of a square? But it guarantees that instead of an even split or whatever, you get a Republican advantage. That's what they're doing down to the granular level. That's what they're doing down to the zip code level. And it is being done with great alacrity right now because they recognize that the power in the hands of these older, whiter, more male people is constricting, it is shrinking. Particularly, I'm here on HUR, I am black, I talk about black people. I don't say black and brown because, brown is a different constituency that votes, not that all black folks vote the same way.
Absolutely, I get your point, go right ahead. Yeah. I get what you're saying.
But when we talk about whose vote they are explicitly trying to break up, this is a racial issue. This is a black issue. This goes back to the peculiar institution when they didn't want us reading. They changed the laws that said any landowning male, they said, oh, wait, black men own land. We got to take that right from them, too. They always constrict our power, our vote, and our ability to be politically solvent in these United States. And this is just the game plan. So we can't assume that playing by the rules is going to benefit us. We have to get in the position where we too can write the rules. We too can deny the rule changes so that what we do continues to stick.
And that's the point that I was making. With elections having consequences, if the Democrats are in a position to write the rules, to change, to be, particularly more clever in how they operate their politics, if they were in the position that Republicans, for example, Mitch McConnell is now, that they would do the same, because that really is how the game is played. But apparently, the Republicans seem to have been able to master that process a tad bit better than the Democrats have, at least on the Hill in the Senate. I want to move quickly, because we only have a few minutes left, to two more issues. And the first one is this dust up in the Loudoun County schools last night. The school board had to shut down a meeting because it became too unruly. There was a man who was arrested, and these issues were over two things. One, about the use of pronouns and for students who identify in the LGBTQ community, specifically non-binary or transgender students. And the other thing is the critical race theory issue. Mary, I'll start with you. This seems to be what's happening in Loudoun County may be the litmus test for these two issues going forward.
Oh, yeah, this they're going to pick on transgender kids because they can. And a gym teacher saying that he wouldn't follow the policy of calling children by their preferred pronoun and because of his beliefs, which that's the school policy. And the other one about critical race theory, which I did a podcast on Equal Time about it, people, it's not even taught in K through 12. They have no idea what critical race theory is, which is not about individuals, it's about systems. But yet it's become this bucket that they throw anything in if anybody wants to bring up the history of this country that deals with race and the fact that so many laws and systems affect everything from housing to health care, which we've seen in this year of COVID, to policing, which we have seen. And the thing of it is, these people are acting out. When you look at this behavior, when they're casting themselves as victims and attacking other people, and it is a shame. I mean, Loudoun County, I think, was a long time before that school system was integrated, and it seems like they're still fighting it. They're fighting the fact that there's diverse groups of kids here, and even the white kids really need to learn about the history of our country in a way that's truthful. And as I said, this between critical race theory and attacking transgender kids, it seems like to be talking points in a culture war when, as Ingrid said before she left, they don't have really much else.
And it also seems to me, particularly as it relates to the use of pronouns, to be a generational split, just making, you know, some of the observations from the ruckus, you know, last night. Yes, some of the, you know, some of the younger participants appear, to support the use of pronouns. It's one of those things where, whether you like it or not, this is the way the world is moving, and so we need to certainly catch up. But as I said, Jamila, some people want the world to remain the way it was, but and there's the rub.
There is the rub, but here's the thing, and I'm not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV, but I do cover all things First Amendment. And here's the thing that there was an elementary school gym teacher in
yes.
Loudoun who wouldn't use the child's pronouns, and this is going to be kicked up to a higher court because it's First Amendment all over. It's his right of religion versus his right of free speech. Now, he's saying, you cannot compel me to refer to a child as he when I know that that child was fearfully and wonderfully created by the Jesus that I worship to be a girl. I will not call that girl a boy because that's in violation of my deeply held religious beliefs. Now, this is not a state law. This is a policy, the way dress codes at work are policy. There's more legal precedent for restriction of free speech at work. You know, no elementary school teacher can say, okay, class, I'm going to teach you about George Carlin's 7 words you can't say on television. you know, yes, that's a restriction of their free speech, but we all know what would happen if little Johnny came home talking about, teacher said MF today. The thing is, these people are funded and they're dug in, and you know, the fact that you have some religious folks who are willing to put up the fight to say this man's faith tells him he cannot participate in mm-hmm. the way the world is going. This is not an issue that's going away.
Yeah.
It's with us for a while.
Real quick, I only have a minute left. A quick comment. You know, Carl Nassib, a player with the Oakland Raiders, he came out this week saying that he was gay. The LGBTQ community, you know, made a big deal out of it. Good, you know, good for him. Glad that he was able to stand up for who he is. But is this, again, Mary, is this the way the world is? And we just need to, okay, congratulations, keep it moving. And I hope that you can still catch a pass, run fast, and whatever.
Well, the reaction has been, blessedly, pretty much like that. Mm-hmm. I saw one that said, oh, what a surprise. I didn't know the Raiders had moved to Las Vegas. But I also do think that people have to credit some Michael Sam, the African-American player, who came out as gay before the draft.
Yeah.
And he got, you know, he never made an L team. And I'm not sure whether or not that had anything to do with it, but there are a lot of people also who have come out after. But so it is a process, and it's great that he also donated $100,000 to the Trevor Project, which is for suicide prevention for LGBTQ youth.
There we go. So, last word there. Thank you so much, Mary Curtis, Jamila Bay, and, of course, Ingrid Sturgis. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, June 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for Unheard. Good night.